Welcome to Two Bits, Coins and Currency, a podcast hosted by Mitch Sanders and Doug Mudd, a production of the American Numismatic Association.
So coinage was invented in Lydia in western Turkey around 690, 680 BC. And what's always been amazing to me is that within just a couple of centuries after that, coinage spread really all around the Greek world. Lydia was a bit to the east of Greece, but soon after coinage was invented in Lydia, the idea really caught on and spread all around the Greek world. Once it originates, then it really propagates very intensely. I have a friend who's from Greece, and when we've talked about coinage, has told me that in textbook presentations of Greek history, there's a lot of talk about the first Greek coin, which he indicated has a turtle on it, and I think you'll have more to say about that. But it's remarkable that, especially in this environment of city-states, where there were, I don't know how many simultaneously, but there were hundreds of city-states in the relatively small area, the idea of coinage just spread really dramatically, quickly, and pretty extensively in that world.
Right, because it turns out, okay, so the Lydians have developed this new idea of coinage that's marked by the government and is regulated and controlled. And they had close trade ties with the Greeks. Nobody else seemed to be very interested at first. So what happens is the Greeks, starting with the island of Aegina, which is in the Gulf of Athens, they adopted coinage very early on. Based on archaeology and the best chronologies we can come up with, it looks like they were the very first of the Greeks to adopt coinage, somewhere right around the turn of the 600 BC. So 600 BC plus or minus 20 years, something like that. Those were coins that became known as turtles because the badge of Aegina was the sea turtle initially. Later it became a land turtle. So what you have to be aware of is the history of the time. The Greeks were in a period of a political upheaval and change. They were moving out of the Greek Dark Ages, which had lasted from about the 12th century BC up until the 8th century BC. Homer had started writing in the 7th century. Sometime his stories were being written down during the late 7th century BC. The period of the invention of coinage coincides with a reorganization of Greek civilization. The Greeks had originated in the area that we know of as Greece and started to spread out as early as the 800s BC. They began to settle places just across the Aegean and the Aegean Islands and settled on the coast of Turkey and then up the coast into the Black Sea area, across parts of the Mediterranean that were relatively unsettled, and they moved westwards. The east was mostly closed to them because you already had settled peoples there, the Phoenicians and the Egyptians and the Lydians, the Carians, other peoples that were occupying most of the lands along the coast. Well, as the Greeks began expanding, they started to change organization. They had been organized on the level of cities, what we would call small towns, really, because most of these places were 4,000 or 5,000 people. Occasionally they would get bigger. In the early years, Athens was considered to be a very large place with up to 10 or 15,000 citizens, which translated into a population of 50,000 or so, up to 100,000, and then later growing. Well, they had been organized under traditional systems where they had a king, an aristocracy or a king that were hereditary. In the 7th century BC, we have the stories at Athens, for example, of Solon and the upheavals that occurred that got rid of the older system of the kings, and then was replaced by an oligarchic system where you had a group of noblemen that would rule. So what happened was that during this change, this political and cultural upheaval that was going on, the Greeks sending out colonies across the Mediterranean, the change from an old system that was traditional based on hereditary kings and hereditary nobility into an oligarchic system, there developed what we know of as the polis, the Greek word for a city, but it meant more than a city. It was a political organization. It was a way of identifying themselves, the Greeks, as a independent, separate group of people from the other Greeks and from other peoples across the known regions of the world to them. This polis became the center of Greek life and became a center of identity. Into this mix come coinage. And the Greeks very early on realized it's not that coins made trade so much simpler. They did simplify things somewhat, but previous peoples over the millennium before the development of coins had been using metal and had even marked metal in some ways, not quite coinage because they didn't have standardized weights or they didn't have standardized systems of marking. But the big change was that coins allowed the Greek cities to identify themselves. So now you have a gina. It issues coinage, and it issues coinage with a badge, not the badge of the ruling dynasty, but the badge of the city, which is a completely different political idea. It means that all people born in Aegina that are citizens of Aegina identify with this coinage, not just the king. This idea was so compelling that in my view, and this is, there are people that have different views of this, but in my view, this is what really changed how coins developed. Because the Greeks took this idea, and all of a sudden, as you said, within the next two centuries, you had coinage going from Aegina and Athens and Corinth and the center areas of the Greek homeland and spreading out all the way across the Mediterranean. By the end of the 6th century, you had coins appearing in Sicily. You had coins appearing as far away as northern Spain. You had coins appearing on the eastern side of the Black Sea. This obviously struck a chord with the Greeks. And interestingly, to show you that how different this was from how other people saw this, is that coinage was not adopted nearly as quickly by anybody else. It was basically people of Greek civilization, Greek culture, that adopted these coins. And as you suggested, there were, at one point during this 6th, 5th century period, at least 600 different Greek cities issuing coins. That number grew larger over time, so that by the 1st century BC, you had up to 1,300 different individual entities issuing coins, the vast majority of them being of Greek culture or Greek identity or ruled by Greeks by this time.
So it was a chance to do something from an economic perspective, but also of considerable importance, as you're describing it, a means of expression, because you see that each polis or each city-state has its own coinage, and you see, along with the proliferation of the issues of coinage, so many different designs related to whatever is important for each of these issuing authorities. So just like coinage today, it serves a commercial purpose, and it also serves a purpose of representation or symbolism, and both pieces are important.
Right, and that's one of the things that I think became the critical element, because people, starting with the Lydian kings, realized that coins were a form of messaging. You could tell your people who was in charge, who had issued the coins. It became a form of propaganda, of messaging. And you have to realize this is a period when there's no newspaper, there's no paper. to start with. The, yeah. the closest thing that, that existed in the form of paper was the papyrus. And papyrus was produced in Egypt, was very expensive, and was used almost exclusively in Egypt. You also had the very early developments of parchment, but it was extremely rare and not used in the 5th and 6th century BC. It wasn't until a few centuries later. So how did you pass messages around? There was no TV and radio, of course. So you had the town crier. You had gigantic and very expensive monuments. You had clay tablets. But there was really not much else to pass information around that was cheap and easy to use. Clay tablets were individually made, and they weren't reproduced in any printing method. They were actually written by hand by using a stylus where they'd actually punch in designs. Very tedious and time-consuming. So coins represented the first means of mass communication. You could actually put a message on there in the form of a design that was identifiable to your people and to all the neighbors of your people as coming from your city. This is an important element. So another aspect of the development of money among the Greeks in particular is that this period was the period of the tyrants in Greece. The old systems, the old hereditary systems had been displaced. Oligarchies were in charge, but tyrants started to take over. Tyrants not in the sense that we think of today as an evil dictator, but simply in the sense of a person who took power without the sanction of the authorities. In this case, the authorities would be the gods. Previously, the old dynasties were all related to the gods in some way. The problem is that as a tyrant, you had to be a citizen of the city in order to be able to take it over, unless you conquered it outright. In order to keep control of the city, if you were a citizen, you couldn't trust the other citizens because they'd all be looking at you, like, well, why can't I be the king? So the tendency was to use mercenaries, people from other cities, as your personal bodyguard. There was also a lot of warfare going on. And as I mentioned to start with, these new polis were relatively small. The Greeks were divided into individual cities or small territories in comparison with, say, the Persians or the Lydians and other places. And often they would need mercenaries to help fight their wars. Well, mercenaries could not settle in these areas because they weren't citizens and they were itinerant to start with. They moved around a bit, and it was a whole lot easier to carry coins than it was to travel with flocks of sheep and cattle and other things that were much less movable, especially if your local tyrant was murdered. You had to get out of town quickly. So having the ability to carry a bag of coins as opposed to a flock of sheep was recommended as a way of getting out of town. So it's thought that this was part of the initial thinking, but it was definitely part of why coins were used popularly in the Greek regions, because they could be used for long distance trade as traditionally, but also to pay for mercenaries in the number of increased wars that were occurring at the time.
And also then with all those features, and then I have been thinking about the symbolic elements of coinage and how those persist, because I haven't done a systematic study, but I feel like any book, any textbook that's about the ancient world, there will be a coin pictured probably sooner rather than later, like on the cover, yes. If not pretty quickly once you get into it. Because some things that we know about the ancient world, we know only through coins, and some things that we know in other ways, we can see very clearly presented on coins about these historical changes. So just like today, in contemporary terms, but then also today's historians looking back, and then for Greeks at the time, the messages, it wasn't just a utilitarian item.
Right.
Although it was a utilitarian item, but it had so much more meaning than that.
And historically speaking, it becomes very useful to us because you can start telling that, well, except for example, Athens, one of the major Greek cities for most of the ancient world, most of the classical period, the coinage became standardized relatively early. By the 490s BC, you ended up with what became known as the Athenian owl. The standard design had an owl on it, and it had, on the other side, the head of Athena. The head of Athena was there because Athena was the patron goddess of Athens. And as a patron goddess, she was a focus of Athenian pride, national and religious pride. And the owl, it turns out, is the avatar of Athena. The owl represented Athena and was used, whenever you saw an owl, you would automatically think that Athena is involved because the owl was a representative of her activity. Mm-hmm. And interestingly today, is we still think of the owl as wise, and Athena was the goddess of wisdom and military art. And it's interesting to think that, you know, 2,500 years later, we still speak of the wise owl based on this connection with Athena.
Yeah, that's a strong reputation. And I know those coins have been found all around the Greek world and are still continuing to be found, but they circulated really broadly as trade coins. And then the consequence is they are found all around the hobby of numismatics. There are a lot of Athenian owls out there. I think that's the archetype of an ancient Greek coin that people envision or expect to see. And I mean, they're not common, but you can certainly find them at coin shows because they were made in such quantity for trade purposes and then have been found over the centuries since then.
Right. Athens was particularly lucky in that they happened to have within their territory the mountain known as Laurium. Mount Laurium was basically a very productive silver mine mm-hmm. for many centuries. So for the Athenians, money literally grew in the ground for them because it was right within their territory. So the result was that they were able to produce huge number of coins over a period of basically 400 years plus with standardized designs. And because of the fact that they had a lot of money, because of the success of their trading efforts, and later the success of their military efforts, they ended up being the most important, largest of the Greek cities for a while. And their coinage became a standard that was used throughout the world of the time. So throughout the known world of the time, including from the Western Mediterranean all the way to the borders of Afghanistan, the Athenian owl was recognized as a regular form of coinage. They may not know where Athens is, but they knew that the coins were good, and they were copied throughout that area. Archaeologically and historically speaking, these coins, because they are identified and standardized, and this is, goes across the board for ancient Greek coins, because they could be identified with a city, they give you a lot of information about how important that particular city is by how far away you find the coins. So we know that Corinth, for example, had an amazing trade network that lasted for centuries in parallel with the Athenians because we find Corinthian coins spread all across the Western Mediterranean.
Yeah.
They weren't found as much in the Eastern Mediterranean. They were sort of shut out of that area, but they founded colonies which copied their coinage, and then their coins straight from Corinth were spread throughout a wide region. This becomes very important for us historically in trying to identify the patterns of history and what occurred in what areas at what times.
Yeah, because the coins traveled all over, and like you said, you can see those patterns. And these coins, the owl coins that we're talking about, these are pretty hefty for ancient coins. They're like maybe roughly the diameter of a quarter, but substantially thicker. And because they were trade coins, that made sense. I always think of them as like like the $100 bill. It has a substantial value, and it's something that's accepted all around the known world, and everyone knows what they're getting when they get one, and know they can hand it off to someone else.
Yeah, and the standard denomination you're speaking of is the tetradrachm, which is basically just under 17 grams in weight of silver, and a very distinctive, you know, heavy coin that was very popular and used all over the place. What ends up happening is you start the development of patterns and styles in coinage that become a part of the tradition that some elements are still in use today. Anything from various symbols, the owl as a symbol of wisdom, eventually with the Romans, more symbols get included in that are still used today in politics as political symbols, the eagle and scepter and crowns, things like this. One of the interesting things to me is that the Athenians show a trend that still occurs today for the first time, which is when you have a worldwide trade network, it behooves you to make sure that your money is recognizable and that you don't change it too significantly, mm-hmm. in order that the people on the other ends of the network, especially those that don't trade directly with your city, Athens in this case, will continue to use the coins with confidence. If they stop using them, you lose money because you're not selling essentially your coinage to the rest of the world. And that's a profit to your city. A current example is the United States with our paper currency. People have mentioned and complained about the fact that U.S. paper currency is amongst the dullest and ugliest in the world. I'm not sure that this is absolutely true, but there have been complaints that it hasn't changed much. And when you look into the history of it, it turns out that after World War I, once the United States became the economic world leader, we fixed the look of our currency. In particular, the paper money was what was used throughout the world. Because today, as we all know, the United States money is the second currency of the world. Basically, you use whatever your country produces. In some cases, if you don't produce money, you use American money as your standard, with few exceptions. Now, some countries use the euro. Well, throughout the world, you know that if you take a dollar, you'll find somebody that will accept it in trade.
Right.
And for this reason, we've been very reluctant in terms of economic acceptance to change the designs on our money too significantly. We've always gone small steps at a time. We don't have the freedom in a way that smaller countries have of introducing completely new styles of money with brand new designs, because there's too many people that rely on the money, and it would create too much economic chaos for ourselves and for the rest of the world if we tried to change it too quickly. The Athenians were the first to come up with this problem on a large scale. So for a period of well over 100 years, their coinage changed practically not at all. And even after that, for another 200 years, their coinage changed only very gradually with fairly small steps.
There's virtue in being boring, when the purpose is to project stability and continuity and to promote acceptance. And I think that's one reason why, if you look at an ancient Greek coin, especially these Athenian coins that we've been talking about, they're obviously different, but they're really recognizable as coins, as money. The Greeks invented that idea like they invented so many other ideas. So then when we look back at the ancient Greek world, we see things that are familiar because the concepts and their implementation have come to us from that world. And so we're still using the same ideas and even the same implementations of those ideas. One thing to, I want to ask you about is, first to say, we've been talking about the Greek world, and deliberately and appropriately, because there's more to the Greek world than what we now think of as the country of Greece, as you said, over to the Black Sea and as far as Spain. So Greek coinage, or what we call Greek coinage, is actually a term that encompasses much more than historical mainland Greece. It's throughout the region at the time. So what do you think, and I have an idea about this, but what do you think was the apex of Greek numismatic art? I feel like the coins of Syracuse are often lauded. Syracuse was a city of Greek origin in Sicily. Coins from Syracuse are really lauded as being of outstanding quality. Maybe there's a little bit of hometown pride. I live in Rochester, New York, which is about 100 or so miles west of Syracuse, New York. A lot of things in this region are actually named after Greek locations, because the Greek War of Independence in the early 19th century was being fought at the same time this part of New York was being settled. So we actually have a lot of places with Greek names. But even leaving aside that connection, what do you think was the apex of numismatic art in the Greek world? And then how did that relate to the spread of coinage away from the historical main elements of Greece throughout the Mediterranean world?
Well, the apex of Greek art and coinage is an interesting topic, because since coinage was not only an economic tool, it was also an expression of political and cultural national pride. Greek cities had a tendency to compete across the board. And it's no accident that Greece was the origin of the Olympic Games, for example. This idea of a unified Greek world based on language and culture and shared civilization also encompassed the idea of competition within that world, as each of the city-states vied with each other, either through warfare, which was quite common, but also in more peaceful ways. So they tried to have the best buildings, the best artists, the best athletes, all of this. And this spread to the coinage as well. Now, Syracuse in particular has a reputation of producing some of the most beautiful coins arguably ever produced, but certainly within the Greek world, in part because they are part of the Western Greek world. They're on Sicily, and Sicily and what was known as Magna Graecia, Greater Greece, which is essentially southern and western Italy, these were areas that were colonized early on by the Greeks from the mainland. As early as the early 8th century, Greeks began moving over into the Sicily and to the southern portions of Italy. And one of the things they found in these areas, these new areas, was a vast abundance of land, good arable land, especially when you compare them to Greece. Greece is a land that's rocky and in most areas divided into small plains that are arable, where you can have farms and all this stuff, but relatively few large open areas, except when you get up into central and northern Greece. Well, the Greeks moving westward found Sicily, which had vast areas that were suitable to farming, and even more importantly, suitable for horse raising and other pursuits that required a lot more land. And the same went for portions of southern and western Italy. Very soon after their colonization, within a century, the Sicilian Greeks became proverbial for their wealth. And in a lot of ways, I look at it as being a very similar situation to what happened with Europe, in particular England, with the English colonies in North America, where the colonies ended up becoming greater than the original.
I was thinking the same thing, and we hadn't discussed this beforehand, but as you were talking about the wider Greek world in Sicily that compared to the mainland, I had that same thought, that it had the same genesis the same traditions, but then took it in a different direction.
Right. And so once coinage started to appear, the Sicilian Greeks got onto this bandwagon very early. And by the 480s BC, Syracuse, for example, was introducing new designs on their coinage that were different and innovative in their way, along with certain of the other cities in the Sicilian area. By the end of the 5th century BC, the Sicilian Greeks were sufficiently wealthy and proud of their accomplishments. For example, they had started winning at the Olympic Games earlier in the century. As early as the 480s BC, their horses began to win in the chariot races and the individual horse races. They started to depict scenes of chariots, racing chariots, on their coinage. Well, the Syracusans and other places like Naxos and Catana, these cities expressed their civic pride in a new way by hiring famed artists to start producing their coins. So for the first time, you start seeing coins around the 420s and later that incorporate a signature. So you see names such as Caimon or Ioannitos and others that appear on the coinage for the very first time. And these coins, particularly those of Ioannitos and Caimon, are considered to be among the most beautiful coins ever produced. You end up with special issues, a decadram, so a 10 drachm coin, basically 2.5 times the size of the standard trade coinage, so something that weighs about 40 grams. These are large pieces. They're half dollar size, but twice or three times as thick. They feature these amazing works of art. They're comparable to what was going on in painting and in pottery, in the designs of pottery, where you have this flowering of art that is different from anything else you see during this period, in the sense of the realism, the nature of the depth of the sculpture, the depth of the image, and just the skill. So, for example, on chariots, the initial chariots had been shown as a very static object with, you know, it looks just like a chariot with a round wheel and it's standing, the horses are walking. And you see at first one horse representing several horses in a line, and the charioteer is just standing in the chariot. By 405 BC, you start seeing these chariots where the wheel is an oval, and it's designed in such a way that you can practically see the motion. You've got horses, yeah, four individual horses, one behind the other on the coin, in different stages of galloping, everything pointing towards a moving, active element. This is a true masterpiece of numismatic art that is rare to be seen ever afterwards, you know, to the modern day, practically.
Especially when you consider that everything had to be done by hand and on the scale of a coin. It was not, in the modern world, you would have a plaster model. Well, actually, in the modern world, you'd have a computer model, but for most of modern history, you'd have a 12-inch plaster that could be reduced to coin size, but the Greeks, they engraved their dies by hand, and they did it at the exact same scale of a coin. And they had to be, everything had to be produced by hand from the creation of the strip from which the blanks would come, and then the cutting of the blanks and placing the blank between the two dies and banging on it with a hammer. You know, it was such a primitive production by today's standards, yet it produced such beautiful works of art. And so now, thinking about modern coinage, when Theodore Roosevelt saw an exhibition of ancient Greek coins, in the early 20th century, his thought was, again, like you mentioned, with respect to civic pride and accomplishment, his reaction was, let's make coinage as beautiful as what they had now in the modern world. So he chose his role models very well and also replicated the process of the issue of these original coins as a way to show civic pride and to show the accomplishments of the civilization.
Right. And it truly was an amazing accomplishment when you think that, A, they're working in the real size, the actual size, like you're talking about. They're working in reverse because they have to carve into the dies in reverse the image that they want to appear on the coin. And they didn't have any magnification that we know of. They didn't have eyeglasses. They didn't have lenses. There's some speculation that perhaps they could have used some sort of bowl with water, but the Greeks in the 5th century BC had no clear glass as we think of it. Glass was only just barely starting to appear, and it was extremely expensive, and it was by no means clear in, like we think of it today. So they didn't have any way of magnifying things, which meant that these artists had a very short productive period of perhaps 15 or 20 years before their eyes would go. You know, maybe it extends to 25, 30 years, but most people by the time they're in their 30s start to see a degradation of their eyes. Certainly by their 40s they do. And then when you think about the materials they used for the dyes themselves, these works were fairly ephemeral. Today, you expect to have somewhere in the order of 250,000 impressions made from a dye. In the ancient world, the best estimates are somewhere between 10,000 and 15,000 coins could be made from a dye. So these dyes would have to be made over and over again, and they did not at that time have the idea of the punch, so they had to be carved anew completely.
Right. If you need a new die now, you go to the master materials and you make a new one, or you make a bunch all at once. But in the ancient world, one at a time. So there was a lot of effort. And I think given that, remarkable consistency, you can identify different characteristics of different dyes. Die varieties, I guess, were endemic in the ancient world because every die was unique, but still much greater level of consistency. Especially compared to what I might expect from something done by hand over such a long period of time.
And a greater degree of artistry, at least among the top Greek cities. It wasn't until later that the artistry dropped off based on the development of empires and a little bit less attention to the detail. But these early pieces really did reflect a level of civic pride, a level of production that has been rarely matched ever since. Certainly not under the Romans, even though the Romans created a very consistent coinage that was spread throughout this vast empire. The quality, the artistry of the Roman coins never really approached what the Greeks were able to do.
It's civic pride, and also I have to say I feel proud of that accomplishment. I know, obviously I wasn't there, I had nothing to do with it, but just that people did something like this under such difficult circumstances. They produced this lovely artistic coinage in this very quote primitive way compared to the methods that we have today, and produced such a beautiful result. It reminds me, now that we're talking about when I went to the Duomo in Florence, which is, I don't know how tall it is, but it's a giant cathedral, and it was built, you know, roughly around 1300, and, you know, there were no machines, and you had to haul these stones up hundreds of feet, and it was just so amazing, and I remember feeling like wow, I'm part of the same species that did this. I felt really a sense of human pride, and Greek coinage, I think, is similar. It's such an achievement that even 2,500 years later, we're still talking about it and really revering it for for what it was able to, what was able to be done at the time.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think your comparison is very apt in that, you know, it's not the pyramids, but the quality in miniature that appears and the consistency that they were able to produce is comparable in many ways in an artistic level to some of these great, huge, massive projects. I find it to be incredible that you can get such a unified body of work across a culture for such a long time.
Right. It's not the same as building a giant edifice, but it's got a substantial magnitude spread out over a longer period of time and a longer or a much broader geographic range. It's not one thing in one place. It's something that contributed to civilization really everywhere, all around the Mediterranean. At some point in Greek history, then we get to Alexander the Great, who I know had a great influence, among other things, on coinage. So who was Alexander? Why was he great? And how did his influence affect coinage in the Greek world?
That's a great question, because Alexander the Great and his empire was critical in the further development of coinage. In particular, his empire basically formed the bridge between the Greek world and the rest of the world in accepting coinage. Without Alexander the Great, the Greeks would have continued as basically the users and issuers of coinage, and perhaps many of the cultures of the Middle East wouldn't have begun using them as a standard part of their money system.
What period of time was this that Alexander's greatness was on display? And it wasn't for very long, right? He died young.
Yes, he did. He became king of Macedon, which is in northern, what is today northern Greece, southern Balkans, and he became king in 336 BC. And he spent the next 13 years until his death in 323 BC conquering most of the known world, which he did extremely successfully and in an amazing short span of time. So he took basically a small kingdom, Macedonia, and with the army that he and his father had built up, was able to conquer an empire that spanned from Greece in the north to Egypt in the south. They conquered the old Egyptian kingdom all the way to Afghanistan and into India, actually, which was just an enormous empire. Nothing had been seen of that size before that time. And what was truly amazing is the speed with which he did it. Well, what this did was set up a situation where Greek culture, Greek civilization, was spread to areas that had heretofore only had indirect contact with it, and in some cases had virtually no contact with it at all. As he went, he conquered different areas, and he formed cities. He formed new cities all over the place, which became the focus for Greek culture. He brought in Greeks and Macedonians, often Macedonian veterans were settled in these cities, along with merchants and other people designed to help hold these places down for this new empire. And these cities, in many cases, became long-lasting foundations. So you have something like 16 Alexandrias, so yeah. You know, cities named after himself. You have dozens of cities named after different, sometimes cultural things in the Greek world, sometimes after his horse, sometimes after other leaders. And
wait, the city was named after his horse?
Yeah, I think there were four cities named after Bucephalus, his war horse.
And there was a whole story, part of Alexander's legend that is involved there, where Bucephalus was a difficult young horse that was being sold by a horse dealer in Pella, the capital of Macedon. And his father, the king, Philip II of Macedon, had rejected it because it was too wild, untamable. And Alexander, at the age of, I believe it was 13 or 14, was able to tame the horse, and they became inseparable friends from then on. And Bucephalus, he kept with him through his conquests, and finally the horse died in maybe 327 BC, and was buried with full military honors somewhere in Afghanistan.
Okay, I guess I would feel okay then about living in a city named after a horse, given what you described. But sorry, that was a detour from numismatics. Yes. So it sounds like then, so Alexander, you know, kind of a comet rising quickly, died young, conquered, as you said, most of the known world, and then the empire receded, but the culture remained. The Greek influence still existed.
The empire lasted after his death for a little while as a unified empire, but only a little while, and then was succeeded by a generation of warfare. So Alexander died at the age of 36, but what he left behind was a network of cities and mints. So for the first time, you had a huge empire that was issuing coinage throughout all of its parts. And this coinage was based on the Greek model and was a single entity. So basically, they all used the same denominations. They used the same designs on coins that were struck in Pella in Macedon, all the way to Iconium in Afghanistan. These coins were struck with the same designs and on the same standard. What made this possible was the conquest of the Persian Empire. The Persian Empire was an empire that had been in existence for, by this time, 150 plus years, and they'd accumulated vast amounts of gold and silver that were kept at its capital at Ctesiphon and other royal locations in modern Iran and Iraq. It's estimated that the amount of gold was unbelievable, something like 6,000 talents of gold, and a talent was 60 pounds of gold. Mm. And it had been accumulated and was basically sitting in vaults. This gold and the vast amounts of silver was taken and turned into coinage to pay for the army and pay for the projects that Alexander undertook. So the creation of these new colonies, these cities all throughout the empire, were financed by the use of this gold and silver, which was coined for the first time and created a monetary system that was brand new and unique for its time.
So then at this point, with the spread of Greek culture, under the banner of Alexander and then the empire to the extent that it persisted, then is it fair to say that is kind of the closing chapter of this major story of the Greek world and its coinage? And then from this point forward, now we're starting to transition to the Roman world and the Roman world of coinage, which will be a subject of a future podcast. But is this like the curtain for the Greek civilization as we know it, and then for that definition of coinage that we think of as coinage of the Greek world?
It leads to that curtain. So before Alexander, you have a system of coinage that essentially is Greek in nature. There are some non-Greeks that use coinage, essentially the Phoenicians, another great trading people, adopted coinage from the Greeks. And in Lydia and the regions of the Western Middle East, so the coastal areas of Phoenicia and Turkey, there were coins in use by people other than the Greeks. But essentially, it was a Greek phenomenon, and Alexander changed all that and spread the use of coinage to Egypt, for example, and then spread it all throughout the eastern portions of his empire. So the Fertile Crescent, Mesopotamia, Babylonia, those regions, and then further east until they got to India, where in India there was coinage. It had been in existence for approximately roughly 100 years before, but it was on a different standard. They used silver, didn't really use gold. They did have some copper, but essentially they used it in the form of small bars and shaped pieces that were similar to coins, but not coins as we know them. They were counter-stamped. What ended up happening, the influence of Alexander's empire altered the Indian coinage system significantly, so that what you ended up with there was a blend of East and West, with the Indian coinage system blending with the Greek system to create something a little different that was new. And some of those ideas circulated back and forth. Anyway, so Alexander's empire forms the transition in traditional thinking about coinage from the classical Greek coinage system to the Hellenistic Greek coins. Hellenistic coinage is characterized by the fact that primarily you now see kings being represented on their coins. You do still see individual cities and the traditional city emblems being shown, but the major coinages are those of the successor kingdoms that followed the breakup of Alexander's empire shortly after his death. So you have Seleucid coins. So Seleucia, the Seleucid Empire, was based on the eastern conquests of Alexander in the Mesopotamian region. It had its capital in Babylonia, and then Seleucia, which was a foundation that became one of the biggest Greek cities in the world, actually, with well over 1 million people at one time, right there on the Euphrates River. And it occupied a vast region from the borders of India all the way to the shores of Phoenicia, modern Lebanon, and northern Syria. Then you had the empire under the Ptolemies, which consisted of Egypt going occasionally into Palestine and that area. But basically, the old Egyptian empire became the Ptolemaic Empire. And then you had the Macedonian kingdom, which is centered on Macedonia, normally controlled all of Greece and controlled much of the Turkish areas, so the Asia Minor. Those kingdoms became the center of the Greek world and Greek thinking for the next 2.5 centuries before the advent of Rome.
Okay, so it was a long curtain. I described it as the curtain, and there was a lot more going on, but Hellenistic in the sense that it was informed by Greek culture, but it was not Greece proper, and then also had this thematic difference where instead of seeing animals or gods or allegories or symbols, you might still see those, but you would also then see the actual images of the rulers, which is, yeah, you know, now commonplace, but someone had to invent it, and that's where it was.
Yeah, they set the tone for coinage forever after, particular royal coinage or imperial coinage. Mm-hmm. So the ruler of the kingdom or the empire would become the primary subject. And for the first time, I mean, there had been some experiments in the 4th century, in the 360s and 350s, but for the first time you see realistic portraiture of an individual appearing on the coins. At times with the Greek portraiture, they tried to be realistic, but they also tried to be flattering as well at times.
Sure.
So you get the development of some amazing coinage. One of the things I find really interesting about this is that some of the best of the portraiture actually appeared in what is today Afghanistan in the Greek kingdom of Bactria, where you get a whole series of absolutely stunning portraits of rulers, many of whom, perhaps 50% of them, are unknown to history otherwise.
Yeah.
So the Bactrian kingdom was amazing because here you have this far outpost of the Greek civilization, right on the borders of India, in the middle of an area that had not had a high civilization of its own. You had India to the east, you had the Persians to the west, but in between was basically an area that was closely related to Central Asia and had been dominated by these various tribes over a period of many centuries. So the Greeks formed this kingdom, and shortly afterwards, by 250 BC, they get cut off from the rest of the Greek world because of the advent of the Parthians and Central Asian steppe nomads into the region between Eastern Seleucid Empire and Bactria itself. Bactria centered on Afghanistan and moving into India was then isolated, and we hear very little of the history of that area from the Greeks anymore because they are cut off. But they survived for another 200 years as independent kingdoms, and the very last few of them actually disappeared somewhere around 50 AD in what is today Pakistan, which is incredible. On the other side of the Hindu Kush Mountains, in a whole different region of the world, and yet they were able to produce amazing coinage and architecture, and they created a synthesis of art and even philosophy that is unique to the world. The first bilingual coinage appears in that region, for example. So there's amazing stories that can be found as you look through this Hellenistic period.
Yeah, so diverse geographically and otherwise. And then with the Hellenistic period, then as that comes to an end, now finally we have the time to bring the curtain down on Greek coinage, right? Did I finally get it right? That was premature.
Yes.
Before, but then we bring down the curtain. And then when the curtain rises again and we talk about coinage, it'll be with respect to the Roman world, and that'll be a subject for a future podcast, for sure, with its own twists and turns and its own interests. But before we leave the subject of numismatics in the Greek world, I'm going to ask you two questions. And because the numismatic maxim is buy the book before the coin, I don't 100% agree with that ordering all the time, but I'm going to follow the maxim in the way I ask you the question. What are a few good books about Greek coinage for someone who's kind of getting into it and wants to get started and learn more? And then my follow-up question will be, if you were starting a collection of Greek coins, where would be some directions to go, some places to start? So first books, what are the key books that you would recommend for understanding of the world of Greek coinage?
Well, the standard book that's been used for many years is David Sears' Greek Coins and Their Values. It's a two-volume set, and it basically covers all of Greek coinage in handbook format. It's not complete, but it covers everything at least a little bit. And so it's been used for many years by collectors as a general guideline.
It doesn't cover everything, but it covers, I don't know what percentage it covers, but it's covering the things that a collector is most likely to encounter. The more rare or esoteric wouldn't be included. And I have those volumes, and it's a nice combination of general history about the world of Greek coinage, then gets into the geographies and including city-states and some of that specific history, and a lot of pictures of different issues. So it checks all three boxes then, with general history, specific history, and photos.
Correct. And that's why it's been a very popular sort of handbook.
Yeah.
The foundational work that, if you're really serious about ancient coins, you should probably have a copy of, even though much of it has been superseded by more specific works, is the work by Barclay Head, who was a curator at the British Museum back in the 1880s, 90s, through the early 20th century. And
is that Historia Numorum? I have a copy of it.
Exactly. So Barclay Head's Historia Numorum is a foundational work for ancient Greek coinage. And in particular, what he did was he listed every city, every kingdom that was known to him at the time. There are some additions that have been added since then, but he also created the way that we look at ancient Greek coins in a geographic sense. So he basically started with Spain in the west and went eastwards across the northern Mediterranean out to Asia Minor, where he took a sojourn to the east, covered the Bactrians, and then went down south through Palestine and Judea into Egypt, and then westwards across North Africa to Morocco. And that organizational approach to studying Greek coins has been used ever since. Otherwise, it would have been nearly impossible to view Greek coins because they come from so many different geographical areas and different time periods. By doing this, he actually created a system that was manageable that nobody's thought to change since then, simply because it makes sense. Everybody's been using that system ever since. And that's why that book becomes a critical element in any library if somebody's serious about ancient Greek coins.
And it's in the form of an encyclopedia, right? So you can conceivably flip through it, right? You don't have to read it cover to cover. And it does have an organization, but I always enjoy books that you can just open up and find something potentially interesting wherever you go.
Right. And from that standpoint, it's interesting reading for the bits it has. It doesn't have enough to be conclusive on any particular set, but it gives you a nice overview. When it comes to introductory books, one of the best for ancient Greek coinage, and it goes into Roman coinage as well, so ancient coinage as a whole, is the series of books by Wayne Sales. Mm-hmm. There's Ancient Coin Collecting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 up through 6, in which he covers the whole subject of ancient coinage very well, going into the Eastern empires, going into Greek coins per se, going to Roman coins. The first volume is a general introduction to the whole shebang of ancient coinage. So they're great books and cover a vast number of topics very nicely.
I have some, maybe not all, but I have some of them, and they're pretty contemporary. I don't know exactly when they were published, but they were, unlike the other books that you mentioned, they were published within my personal memory. So
yeah,
maybe 20 years old or so. But you know, so they one interesting thing about ancient numismatics is that it's been studied for a long time. So there are still references from the 19th century that are still current, but the volumes that you just mentioned by Wayne Sales they have more of a contemporary sensibility. So it's a nice addition to the mix.
Yeah, and they cover not only the history, but they're also interesting because, as you say, they're contemporary and they cover some of the current issues, including the volume 6 is counterfeiting and counterfeits, and mm-hmm. helps you to identify what that means in the ancient coin context, because there's basically two different levels. There's the contemporary counterfeits, i.e. counterfeits that were made at the time in order to fool people at the time, and then modern counterfeits that were made for a variety of reasons to either replace coins that collectors might want but couldn't find, mm-hmm. or to fool collectors and take advantage of the high prices for especially rare coins that are on the market today. Yeah. So it's a very worthwhile read. If nothing else, the volume 6 is worth it from what it tells you about the counterfeiting market.
It's another perspective. We could construct a whole syllabus about books on ancient coins and ancient Greek coins and even specific areas of ancient Greek coins. Is there any, but in terms of like general introductions or key volumes for beginners, is there anything else that you would recommend? I think we've named some good ones so far.
There's some, there's a few good ones. There's books by Colin M. Cray and Norman Davis. There's one on the Hellenistic Kingdoms, Portrait Coins and History by those two authors, which is a great general introduction to the kingdoms of the Hellenistic world and the coins. There's a great discussion of the coins themselves, how they were made, what they were intended to convey. And Norman Davis has had a book on his own called Greek Coins and Cities. It's a book about the earlier period where this individual Greek cities existed, and what designs they chose, what you see on their coinage. It's a great discussion and covers a huge number of types. What you find is that during the period before the Hellenistic kingdoms, there were well over 1,000 Greek cities that were issuing coins on their own. Yeah. And the fact that they issued these coins for a period of 150 to 300 years before Alexander the Great is, it gives you an idea of the vast array of coinage that's possible in this series.
Yeah, very, very diverse. Okay, well, that's a good reading list for a beginner to the subject of ancient Greek coins. And then this is another subject we can only scratch the surface of, but you know, what are some key recommendations that you might have about directions to go in for acquiring a few Greek coins for someone who might just be getting started, like some particular things to look for or particular avenues or approaches? Like you said, there are hundreds of places that issue coins. So, you know, the idea of like collecting in a systematic way, it almost defies that because there's so much, but as like a sampling or an overview, what are some things that you'd recommend?
I think it's all very personal to the collector. You know, what is it that you're interested in, that kind of thing. But a standard method is to select a city that you're particularly interested in. Athens, because of its importance historically, is a very popular city to collect. Their coinage is relatively stable and so doesn't require a huge number of coins to create a series. They basically kept the concept of an owl and the head of Athena as their standard design for several centuries. And so there's not a lot of variation except as you go through the denominations from the tetradram or the decadram, which is their largest coin, down to the smallest pieces.
We talked about this earlier, how Athens basically lived next door to a mountain of silver. So they had a lot of silver to make coins with. And so these tetradrams, I think of them as like $100 bills, and that they were issued from Athens, but they were trade coins, and they went all around, and they're still being found, even today. They're still being excavated. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's probably like the Morgan dollar of ancient coins, is that you see a lot of them, and they're really nice. They're really impressive coins.
Yeah, there are a lot of them still available because they did produce the same basic design in vast numbers for well over 100 years. And then they changed the design somewhat and produced vast numbers of those for another 100 years or so. And so their coins are common and they have a great story to them because not only does Athens represent the pinnacle of Greek philosophy, Greek culture, mm-hmm. it also represents the pinnacle of a Greek trading city. They became the trading center for the world for centuries. And as such, their coins were the first world coinage. Mm-hmm. Now it's a world that's smaller than we think of, but it, from the Western Mediterranean all the way to the borders of Afghanistan, you could find Athenian coins, and those coins, the designs were copied by peoples in all the areas in between.
Yeah.
So that's one way of doing it. If you are interested in art and variety in coinage, you could go to the Sicilian coinages. Syracuse would be a prime contender there because you've got the development of masterpieces of numismatic art from a very early period, including signed pieces. So for those interested in in the history of engraving and engravers, you can actually find some of the earliest engravers associated with coins in Syracusan art.
Some of the engravers are known by name.
Right? Exactly.
Getting a St. Gaudens gold coin.
Exactly.
These artists.
So you get people like Kaimon, Archimon, Ioannatos, and other known artists that are very collectible. Other ways of looking at this is perhaps there are a lot of people that like to collect animals on coinage. Yeah. So elephants on coinage, and you could collect a vast series of ancient Greek coins with different elephants on them. Then perhaps you're interested in a particular region. Maybe you're interested in ships. Maybe, you know, there's a whole vast array of possibilities. Personally, I'm interested in the political and economic element. So having a Corinthian coin, because Corinthians were very important in the trade of the Western Mediterranean, having a Phoenician coin because of their importance in the trade of the Eastern Mediterranean and North Africa, Athenian owl because of its importance in trade, that kind of thing is of interest to me, for example.
A few years ago, I decided my collection did not adequately represent the ancient Greek world with coinage, so I went to the New York International Show the next time I was there, and I just tried to get a diversity of ancient Greek coins, including an Athenian tetradram and an electrum piece and a stater from Corinth and just various things. You know, it was like any coin shopping experience. I could only see what was in front of me at the time, so I was making selections from within that. But it was a nice little group, and I'm sure I'll expand it. But that's one really cool thing about it. That you can do it in so many different ways. And that's true of every element of numismatics, but I think especially ancient Greeks, because there's so many issuers over such a long period of time with such diversity of design and circumstances. That's what makes it so interesting.
Absolutely. And one of the primary way that I got into collecting ancient Greek coins was through the Parthian Empire. So collecting by kingdom, particularly from the Hellenistic period, is very doable. Mm-hmm. You've got a variety of choices. Some kingdoms are smaller than others, and so the variety of coinage is not so great that it's impossible to collect them. And there's different ways of collecting within those series. So you can focus on getting a coin from each ruler of the place. So in my case, that's what I do. I try to get an example of a coin from each of the Parthian rulers. And in other cases, you might try to focus on a particular ruler, Antiochus, the great of the Seleucid Empire, perhaps, and try to get examples of denominations and types of each of his coinage. You could concentrate on the coins of Egypt. You can concentrate on a small kingdom like the kingdom of Cappadocia in central Turkey. There it's relatively simpler, but the coins are less common, so perhaps harder to find in the market.
You can take an overview and sample from different elements of the coinage. You can also dive in and, for a particular issuing entity, deal with different rulers or different denominations. It's really, this is why people have been studying ancient Greek coins for centuries, and there's still more to be written and more to be said, and such a vast amount of knowledge, because there's just so much to it. But you know, like with anything, you can start small, start with a few representative pieces, and then take it from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you can even go into collecting by mints. So for mm-hmm. Alexander the Great's empire, for example, one of the popular things to do is collect the drams, which are relatively smaller and less expensive, but created in the same vast array of different mints as the tetradrams. So you can collect Alexander drams and tetradrams from dozens of different mints that are spread throughout his empire. And that becomes a very satisfying way to collect his coinage as well as other types of ancient coinage.
Yeah, and that, right, something from Alexander, given his historical importance, would make sense as something to include in a representation.
So that wraps up our discussion of ancient Greek coins. We've covered a lot of different topics, and hopefully this will serve to introduce you, our audience, onto the subject that can be a very satisfying exploration of a new area of coin collecting.
You're right, it's a very interesting subject and very interesting to collect, and I'm glad we talked about it on this episode. So to everyone listening, thank you for listening. Hope you enjoy your Greek coin experience, whatever it may be, and we'll speak with you next time.